Chapter 3. Playmates. I grew up in Sydney. Between 1950 and 1960, my family rented a flat at 5 Auburn Street, Neutral Bay. It was a very Anglo-centric experience. Our landlord, Mr. McCarthy, lived in the same building with his wife and 2 daughters, Anne and Lynn. Their more imposing section of the building faced Ben Boyd Road, with our front gardens divided by a high and unclimbable wooden fence. The McCarthy sisters were some years older than me, at an age when a few years can often create an unbridgeable gulf. As a result, play dates were rare. Next came the McBurney siblings, Robert and Alexandra. Robert was my age, and Alexandra was a little younger. They lived with their parents in a rented 2-bedroom first-floor flat that faced Ben Boyd Road, and our backyards were separated by a low timber-framed wire fence. I mostly went to play at other people's homes, because my middle-aged parents actively discouraged filling our small flat with noisy children. For them, one child was enough. They were quietly relieved that my troubled brother, 12 years older, had already left home, and were relishing the peace and quiet his absence created. I frequently visited the McBurney's flat. Getting there was quick. I scampered across our concreted backyard, scaled the low back fence, crossed the spongy green grass beside the spreading mulberry tree, skirted the hill's hoist, sometimes festooned with washing, and clambered up the flight of red brick steps to their back door. Often it was open. I would knock politely and enter. Mrs. McBurney was a self-employed dressmaker, who worked from home. Her Singer treadle sewing machine had pride of place against a wall in the main bedroom, where, from the 3 windows that faced Ben Boyd Road, glimpses of Sydney Harbour could be seen. Then as now, harbour views, however tiny, were a status symbol. Mrs. McBurney specialised in wedding dresses. Sometimes, when I arrived unannounced, she would be fitting a bride-to-be in an exquisite white creation of plain or embroidered satin, often embellished with a combination of lace, organza, beads and small covered buttons. The dresses mostly comprised a fitted bodice, sheer sleeves and always a voluminous skirt, that was held out with masses of tulle petticoats. Variations of this design epitomized the style of many 1950s wedding dresses. Mrs. McBurney used their small entrance vestibule for fittings, where she had a full-length mirror, screwed to the wall. From their adjoining living room, I had an unobstructed view of the steady stream of young women, preparing for the most important day of their lives. Some were shy, others more worldly, all trusting Mrs. McCarthy to work her fabric magic to make princesses of them all on their big day. Without doubt, my exposure to the behind-the-scenes preparations for the big day fueled my already well-ingrained infatuation with brides and weddings. In addition, the McBurney's grassed backyard had great appeal for games of all kinds. Particularly for picking mulberries, the best game of all. Their mulberry tree held a special place in our hearts. It grew close to the southern boundary fence. When the tree was fruiting, I would pick my way between the windfalls to climb the fence, balancing carefully, before stepping across into the fork of the tree. This fork was the perfect spot from which to reach the numerous surrounding branches, all loaded with plump, juicy black mulberries. Occasionally I collected some for my mother, using a small tin can with a homemade wire handle. How many mulberries made it back to our kitchen, I can't recall, but I always returned home with a full tummy, as well as mulberry-stained face, fingers and clothes. And lastly, Peter George Forrester, my most constant playmate. In the mid-1950s, he and his family came to live in the block of flats next door. The Foresters were refugees from Hungary, and had a lucrative electrical store at Summer Hill, a Sydney suburb some distance from Neutral Bay. When television came to Sydney in 1956, their business boomed. Naturally, the Foresters had the biggest and best black and white television in Christendom. Whenever possible, I would visit Peter George at 5:30 on weeknights, to watch the Mickey Mouse Club on Channel 9. He and I, usually in our pajamas, would lie on our tummies, very close to the screen, and watch, enthralled. We sang along with the program host, Jimmy.
Who's the leader of the class that's made for you and me? M-I-T, K-E-Y, M-O-U-S-E. Hey there, hi there, ho there, go as welcome as can be. M-I-T, K-E-Y, M-O-U-S-E.
Of all the Mouseketeers, Annette Funicello, with her dark hair and winning smile, was my favorite, by a country mile. I found visiting the foresters quite exotic, as the mouth-watering smells that emanated from their tiny kitchen often filled the flat. There was goulash, stuffed cabbage leaves and capsicums made using precious family recipes that were potent reminders of their home country, with paprika, the hero ingredient. I don't remember being invited to eat with them. Watching their magnificent television was treat enough. Peter George and I often played together, even though I was a couple of years older. He always had the fanciest toys, including a huge teddy bear and a shiny red pedal car that he would occasionally let me drive. And sometimes, we made things together. On one memorable occasion, we constructed a string telephone. First, we made a small hole in the bottom of two tin cans. Next, we connected the cans with a long length of string, firmly knotting the ends inside each can. By stretching the string, whilst at the same time speaking into the open end of one can, sound would travel along the string and be amplified into the second. We were dead keen to try out our new gadget, but unwisely, we chose a Sunday morning for the trial. As Peter George and I were both early risers, we managed to suspend the gadget across the space between our first floor bedroom windows, before our families awoke. With the string stretched taut, we began to chat as quietly as possible, while aware our parents were enjoying their precious Sunday morning sleep in. But unfortunately, we were not quite quiet enough. To say our unintentionally noisy communication experiment was frowned upon by both sets of parents was an understatement. I recall we were both chastised and our gadget confiscated. A sad day, though. We were not sad for long because we were always on the lookout for our next project. On reflection. My family. I'm the last born, and the second living child, in my family. My brother, 12 years older, left home when I was 5 to join the Australian Army. As a result, I was in effect, raised as an only child. Therefore, the valuable hours spent with the neighborhood kids was my introduction to building and sustaining friendships. These friendships were complemented by the interactions I had during the week, whilst at the Northern Nursery School and beyond. Learning to interact with the locals provided a formative experience, for which in hindsight, I am very grateful. Mrs. McBurney. Mrs. McBurney's bridal dressmaking business added another dimension to the textile exposure I already received at home. My mother was an innovative stitcher. Her most prized possession was a green 1954 Alna Supermatic sewing machine, with its knee control lever. When I was 6 years old, my mother taught me to sew on this machine, and since then, an Alna is my sewing machine of choice. Bride obsession. I occasionally wonder about my childhood obsession with weddings and brides. Probably due in part to the influence of my parents' large wedding photographs that were taken outside the door of the church where they were married. In the photographs, my mother looks radiant, the bodice of her white silk satin, floor-length A-line dress, is beautifully fitted. The finishing touches were a delicate crown veil and a bouquet of white arum lilies, brought in from France. Television in Australia. The Mickey Mouse Club was my first experience of post-World War II American culture. In the late 1950s, American culture gained even greater influence in my life, after my mother hired a black and white television from radio rentals. At that time, we were force-fed a diet of American sitcom reruns and old Hollywood movies, interspersed with the occasional series from the BBC. These programs were punctuated with the occasional homegrown television production broadcast live. However, this formulaic approach to programming remained in place until our local TV production organizations began to produce interesting programs about Australia and Australians.